trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. It's true, I spend my days and many of my nights eagerly shoveling truth and light every direction. It's up to you, though, to catch it, so I hope your reflexes are nimble. I'm happy to welcome Eric Peters from epautos.com back to the show. Eric, great to have you on board.
Well, ditto, Brian, and I hope your arms aren't tired from shoveling all the truth.
That's, as you and I were talking before we jumped on the air, it's a target-rich environment today. There is so much going on, and I guess since the Supreme Court is now on a lot of people's minds, let's start there. I'd like to get your reaction to a leaked memorandum which came out yesterday that says it looks like Roe v. Wade is about to be overturned.
Yeah, apparently Politico got a hold of a memorandum, I guess, or a preliminary opinion of where the court is going with regard to this case. I think it's in Mississippi that would determine whether the principle that is underlying Roe versus Wade would be upheld or not. And apparently it's not going to be upheld. So, of course, this is already triggering all of the people on the left into keening outrage along the lines of when the Orange Man was elected back in 2016. But what's interesting to me is that it's more of a technical legalistic question that they're discussing rather than the fundamental question. Essentially, as I understand the opinion, they're simply deciding whether the federal government has the constitutional authority to decree a national policy with regard to abortion. Not the, you know, the fundamental question is, are we dealing with a life or not? You know, are we dealing with the termination of a human being or not? Nobody wants to touch that, apparently. So we're not allowed to talk about that either. And that helps them to define the issue in a way that completely gets by the pertinent issue. You know, if they frame it in terms of, oh, it's just women's health care, it's just a matter of choice. So there's that. But the one thing I am encouraged about is that at least at the federal level, this might establish a precedent that the federal government may not have the constitutional authority to tell you that you have to have a jab, for instance, or wear a mask. So that's one of the good things that I take from this.
That's, and actually one of the things that I saw was excerpted from this, I guess this is a, I don't know what you would call it. This is the decision being written by Scalia? Okay, so Scalia, it said something to the effect of this is not, basically he says abortion is not mentioned in the Constitution. So if I'm understanding this correctly, this would kick it back to the states, which it was prior to Roe v. Wade. Some states are going to be very rabidly pro-abortion. Some states are going to be very rabidly anti-abortion or pro-life. And I think that's how it should be. But, man, I'm just wondering how long before somebody points out the logic here. If this in fact overturns Roe v. Wade, wouldn't that same logic apply to the Second Amendment? Could we say goodbye NFA 34 and Gun Control Act of 68?
Very possibly. You know, the Byzantine lengths to which they parse the law leave these questions open to much debate. You never know what they're going to pull out of their hat. Essentially, they can pull anything out of their hat that they want to. And somehow Chief Justice Roberts found it constitutional for the federal government to tell you that you have to buy health insurance. And that's not in the Constitution anywhere either. So I wouldn't necessarily count your chickens before they're hatched. What I think is most interesting about this, it's just another parting of the ways, a cleaving of this country into two camps that have irreconcilable values and views on fundamental questions. As you say, certain states are going to pass laws that rightly, in my view, say this is this is an immoral, horrible thing. It's not, it's not about a woman's right to choose. It's about ending life. And this is not acceptable to us for the same reason it's not acceptable to euthanize an old person or somebody who's retarded or has some other affliction. It's just simply an immoral thing. And it's not a matter of choice. You know, we don't say, I'm pro-choice as regards theft or murder. We define these things for what they are and we punish those who commit them. But on the other side, there are people who are absolutely rabidly, diametrically opposed to that idea and would even support infanticide. Actual literal infanticide of born babies after the fact. And you can't come to a meeting of the minds on that. So I think it's just another example of how we're gradually separating into two different societies. And I don't know how ultimately that's going to pan out, but I do see that trend developing.
I applaud you, too, for zeroing in on what really is the crux of the matter versus, you know, the legal minutia that that people mm-hmm. are straining at. I think it was Joseph Sobrand years ago who pointed out that, you know, there was a time where the focus on the discussion of abortion was on the innocent life that was at stake. But it was mm-hmm. successfully shifted over time to, no, this is about the reproductive rights of the woman. And cool. once that innocent life was crowded, you know, not just to the back burner, but basically off the stove, that's all it became about. It was only discussable within the context of the woman's right to choose or not.
Yeah, the left is very adroit at framing issues by manipulation of language. If you can successfully do that, if you can get people to talk about choice, you know, rather than murder, it's very easy to make a compelling argument on a superficial level. Of course, we favor people's right to choose. I mean, we're liberty-minded people, but that's not the issue, is it? You know, it's of a piece with so many other things, and I harp on this a lot. The importance of being very clear about what you're saying, about defining the terms of a discussion before you have the discussion, because you cannot have a coherent, intelligent discussion unless the terms are defined prior to the discussion.
Let's take a moment to talk a little bit about the free speech issue as well, since now we learned that over the last few months, the Department of Homeland Security has been pulling together a misinformation ministry or a ministry of truth. And it didn't flare into existence last week. It was just officially acknowledged last week. Yeah. What's your reaction to the creation of this new bureaucracy?
Well, I'm not surprised by it. First of all, you know, given the general trend of the authoritarians in this country, I fully expected something like that to happen. And it's both alarming and farcical at the same time. You have a literal clown. I forgot this woman's name, Jansky or something like that, that they brought forward and appointed as the head of this new Ministry of Truth, which once again is all about framing language and about suppressing speech by not allowing certain terms to be used. But again, it's comical. You know, you and I are old enough to remember when we go watch James Bond movies, for example, and they'd have the villains with their ridiculously attired evil secret policemen and henchmen and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that's what we've got. You know, that's what these people are. And they don't even realize how ridiculous they look. You know, that they're so afraid of having a discussion, that they're so terrified of the weakness of their own arguments that they have to resort to this sort of a thing. So I think it's a salutary thing, once again, in that it shows their fear and it shows their weakness. I think if they were very confident about their arguments, they'd stand on them and they'd defend them. But since they can't, they have to resort to this sort of thing.
Yep. It's and I'm telling people, starting with myself and then anybody in my immediate circle, if you've ever felt like, you know, at some point we're going to have to get serious about free speech, now is the point. This is the time, because that noose is tightening. It's incremental, but this is a major step towards criminalizing certain ideas, thoughts, and expressions of those ideas or thoughts, and it will be used to punish dissent.
It will, but you know, they're further delegitimizing themselves. And if we have to get to the point of having a kind of underground, or they use this word in the old Soviet Union, a samizdat press, you know, where people would run off mimeographed little broadsheets that they would distribute amongst themselves, so be it. You know, it's gotten to the point where almost everybody understands that the media, in air fingers quotes, is completely unreliable, is compromised, that it shills for the government, that it shills for the corporations that pay all the advertising, and that essentially nothing that they say should be taken at face value and should be questioned. And I think that's good for the liberty movement. It's finally waking people up to the realization that they have an obligation to practice due diligence and to look into things for themselves rather than waiting for some authority figure to tell them what to think.
Yep. And I think this is also a prime opportunity for people to put into action claiming and using their rights. You know, the way you lose your rights is by not using them. They'll atrophy just like your muscles will atrophy. So, you know, that doesn't mean you have to be out there protesting with banners and marching in the streets and with a bullhorn, but you got to exercise that right to free speech and do it proudly and do it without apology.
Absolutely. And by the way, it'll be interesting to see how this business with Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter goes, and whether he did that just simply to monetize it and to use it as another vehicle to sluice money into his pocket, or if it will indeed be a free speech platform. I have my concerns going both ways. He's made noises about, for example, identifying people. You know, so in other words, it sounds like you're not going to be able to tweet. God, I hate that term. It's ridiculous for a grown man to talk about tweeting. but anyway, You know, in other words, you won't be able to do it anonymously. You'll have to be vetted and identified somehow. And you know, that alarms me. I don't like the idea. You know, I'm a public person. You're a public person. That's fine. But for average people who may have something to lose, for example, at work, if they were to put forward an opinion that their employer might find politically incorrect or heretical and could cost them their job, that's a big deal. So it's a way for them to suppress and, you know, to keep people fearful of zipping their lips so that they don't do something that could end up resulting in the loss of job, promotion, or cause problems for their kids and their families and so on. But we'll have to wait and see how it all pans out.
All right. We are talking with Eric Peters from ericpetersautos.com. I've got to take a very quick break here, pay a couple of bills. When we come back, we're going to check in with the Department of I Told You So. You're going to love this story. Stay with us. We'll be back just the other side of these messages.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. We're talking with Eric Peters from ericpetersautos.com. Eric, I saw a very interesting article on your website called The Department of I Told You So. And I'm going to let you go ahead and set the stage for us about the subject at hand.
Yeah, sure. There was a very interesting article that CNN posted the other day, and it was interesting for what it didn't say. What it did say was that those naughty, naughty Ruskies were having problems with the John Deere equipment, tractors and harvesters and so on, that they've acquired as a result of the war in Ukraine, and which John Deere, to punish those pesky Ruskies, had remotely disabled, you know, rendering them useless. And the article went on and on about that, but it said absolutely nothing about what's implied by that. And you and I have talked about this before, these connected vehicles, including farm equipment, that you think are yours. After all, the title's in your name and you paid for the thing. But nonetheless, it's controlled by software that's controlled remotely by the company that allegedly sold you this thing, and which at their whim, they can decide to turn off. If they can do it to the Ruskies over in Ukraine, they can do it to a farmer in Iowa, too.
Yeah, you know, connecting the dots, I know for some people this sounds conspiratorial, but there have been an unusually large number of food processing facilities damaged by fire or explosions or other, you know, mishaps and having to be shut down. There's constrictions on the shipping of fertilizer. There's, you know, of course, the increased cost of oil and all the lubricants and everything that go into keeping farm machinery running. I'm sure getting the impression that someone somewhere is putting the squeeze on our food supply lines.
Sure. And I think the take-home point here is that they have the power to do it in terms of being able to manipulate the function operation of these connected vehicles. And it's not just the John Deere tractors. It's pretty much all the modern cars, too, that have the same connectivity that can be shut off remotely. You know, Tesla, for example, is another thing CNN didn't mention. There was a little blurb that popped up a couple of weeks ago where it was suggested, hey, I know how we can punish those Ruskies. We can have Tesla shut off all of the Tesla vehicles in Russia. And that just disappeared down the memory hole. Again, I think because of the implication. You know, people thought about it a little, but they realized that Tesla and all these other cars could be controlled so easily in a way that was simply impossible before cars got connected, where they'd have to physically, you know, stop you from driving the car. Whereas now they can just send out a signal telling your vehicle not to operate. You know, the computer shuts down the fuel system, or it turns off the battery if it's an electric car, whatever it happens to be. They have that technology. And to think that they're not going to use it at some point in the future, I think is almost childishly naive.
No, I agree. It's really concerning to see that, you know, especially since we know corporate America, for the most part, is willing to go along. There's no place so far that I've seen they're willing to draw the line and say, hey, enough, government. You can't order us to do this.
Well, and because they have gotten in bed with government and they see that as the future of their profitability, particularly with regard to vehicles, what they want most of all now is not to sell you a car and then for you to own the vehicle for as long as you want to own it and be free of debt. What they want is to sell you access to the vehicle, the use of the vehicle. This is the business model that was pioneered by Microsoft more than anyone else, where instead of buying the software package like Adobe, let's say if you're a graphic designer, you pay a license. You know, you pay a fee to license the software, and then you must continue to pay that fee in order to have the license up to date, in order to use the software. And that's how it's going to go with cars if they get their way. You're simply going to pay endlessly for access to or the use of a vehicle, but fundamentally they will own and control it. And they will also, by this mechanism, prevent people from accumulating capital. You know, when you buy a car and you pay for it, all of a sudden you have a car and you don't have a car payment, right? So if you're prudent, you can put aside some of the money that you might otherwise have had to put toward that payment and accumulate capital and then have money to do other things with it. But if life becomes a financial treadmill where essentially you just have to get up and slave away every day just to pay your monthly nut for all of the things that you're renting and licensing and using, you can never accrue capital. And that's, I think, what they mean by that WEF slogan about how in the future you'll own nothing and they'll own everything and be very happy.
Yeah, I'm already not happy. So
right.
They've got an uphill battle against them if they're going to try and win me over to the idea that eating bugs and surrendering everything that I've worked for is
sure.
is going to make me happy.
Sure. I think a lot of people feel the same way. And I think we're rapidly approaching some sort of an inflection point because awareness is dawning. You know, not just on a small cohort of weirdos like you and I and the people who listen to our shows. But the general public is beginning to realize that the government and these corporations are not operating in good faith. They're not operating in our interest as they see them in a benevolent kind of paternalistic way, that they're overtly malignant. And what they're trying to do is impose some kind of a technocratic authoritarian regime where we have essentially no latitude, no flexibility. We simply do what we're told or else they pull the plug on our you know, everything that makes life possible, transportation, food, you name it.
Yep. It certainly makes all of those conversations we've had about self-reliance, you know, keeping some chickens, growing more yep. of your own food. It's starting to make a whole lot more sense. And probably 6 months from now, I think a lot of people will start to see the light. I hope most of them will have taken some steps by then to better their situation.
Yeah, I hope they take it sooner rather than later, particularly now that it's spring and this is a very good time to do it. Parenthetically, one thing that I have been doing, and I do this every year regardless, but I bring it up because I think it's a useful suggestion. I chop down some trees, I split wood so that I have firewood. I have a wood burning stove, and that will provide heat for me and the ability to cook. In the event that I can't get natural gas to run my propane heater, or propane for my propane heater, and the electrical grid goes down, and you can't use the heat pumps and so on. You know, for people who have the ability to burn wood, whether it's in a wood stove or just a fireplace, I think it's really a smart idea right now to store up a sufficiency of wood to get you through next winter, just in case.
Hear, hear. One final note I want to touch on in the last couple minutes that we have here. Your article, Leah and the Electric Car. Let's yes. let's touch on this. We're talking, of course, about Leah Thomas, the transgender yep. swimmer who is just smashing the women's swimming records. Huh, go figure. Yep. How does this relate to electric cars?
The man competing against women. Again, I think it's very important to be very clear about what we're talking about. So what we're talking about here is reality denial when it comes to Leah. And it's also true with electric cars. They've been around for 120 years. They still have the same problem that they had 120 years ago, problems, plural, meaning they cost more, they don't go as far, they limit you because of the recharge times. That's the same problem. Well, rather than accept these realities, what they want to do now is not only reinvigorate the electric car subsidy, you know about this, we've talked about it, that gave everybody who bought an electric car a $7,500 tax kickback. They want to bring that up to $12,500. And my question is, well, at what point do they pull the plug, not just from the wall outlet, but from our wallets, and force us to continue to subsidize these failed products that can't compete on their own and that have to have an artificial advantage, just like Leah has the artificial advantage of being a man, being allowed to compete with women.
Yeah, it's, well, if you want to stay tethered to reality, I guess the only thing I can say is you're going to have to work at it because there's a lot arrayed against you to try to keep you from reality.
There is, but you know, it's really quite simple. I think what you need to do, what I do when engaging somebody in the discussion is just to be very clear about what we're talking about. You know, if they make a statement, then if there's anything about the words they use that are unclear, ask them to define exactly what they mean before participating in a debate on their terms. That's why, for example, I don't talk about whether Leah is a transgender swimmer and has the right to compete with the women. I point out that whatever he wants to identify as is fine. It doesn't change the reality, the objective reality, that he's a guy. He's a dude. He was born a male. He is a male. And whatever he wants to believe he is or identifies as does not change the biological reality of his sex. And period. That's the end of it. And if his feelings are hurt, well, I'm very sorry. You know, sometimes reality bites.
Yep. Yep. Reality is everything that remains when you wish it were otherwise. And unfortunately, that applies exactly. to all of us.
Yep.
Eric,
yeah, you know, reality is the basis of wrongthink, and we need to get back to that.
Amen.
And once we do, I think we'll recover sanity.
No, I appreciate that's a fine note to end our discussion on today. Mm-hmm. Again, we're talking with Eric Peters from ericpetersautos.com. Great to catch up with you as always, my friend. I feel like your conversations are more of a reality supplement than a lot of other stuff in my life. So thank you for that.
Well, I'm happy to oblige, and the same in reply.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Welcome back to the show. I am so happy to bring my friend Spencer Worthington aboard. Spencer's one of our sponsors with HSLAmmo.com. Spencer, great to get you back on the program. It's been a while.
Always a pleasure. Love being here.
All right. Now, normally you and I would be talking about guns and things that go bang. And, you know, we could have a rollicking good conversation about that. But you and I had a conversation not so many years ago about what it's like to really pull yourself together and live with frugality. And I don't mean like grind by in this sad-faced existence, but to basically save money at every opportunity you could. And you told me about how you actually found a kind of fulfillment in doing so. And I was wondering if you would mind sharing that experience with my listeners.
Absolutely. So just to kind of give a little bit of context, I think for some of your, I don't know, middle age and some of your older listeners, that some of the younger listeners might not quite understand was the experience that was 2008, 9, 10, and 11, that you know, kind of financial window where the world was on fire. That was kind of an interesting period to try and adult through, so to say. Oh, yeah. I mean, you yourself, I'm sure you know, I think everyone saw foreclosures left and right and jobs and 401ks disappearing. It was an interesting time to try and, you know, make life decisions. And it was difficult to get ahead, so to say. So me and my wife kind of hit rock bottom. We were doing some subcontracting work and we were in the construction industry. And man, we ate humble pie. We hit rock bottom. And, you know, as a young 20-something-year-old young man, we had one contractor stiff me for $50,000. And
ooh,
that was just one of many business dealings that just failed. And the gentleman went bankrupt, and I got footed with all the bills, unfortunately. So we didn't just hit rock bottom. We hit negative rock bottom. We were, you know, six figures in the hole. And
wow,
in my early 20s, that was humbling. So to go to your mailbox and you get a stack of mail and there's, you know, 10, 15 bills and one piece of junk mail and one piece that's addressed to the wrong address that somebody put in the wrong address. But, you know, you literally owe everyone your life. It's everyone has a stake to your claim to own a piece of you. And that kind of crushing weight is just beyond depressing. So we got hungry for change and we decided, you know, this is not a way to live a life owing people. And we decided we were going to try and fight for our freedom. And it really came with a re-education of the way you have to think. And it really came down to looking at money differently. And a saying that I've grown to love is, like you yourself have seen when people win the lottery, how quickly they become bankrupt, right?
Right. There's no sense of responsibility tied to that money.
Right. And the saying I've learned to love is that financial literacy is not a side effect of wealth. Like, you don't just get money and then learn how to handle it. Wealth is a side effect of financial literacy. Once you learn to understand money, you will accumulate wealth. You don't just all of a sudden, like, if your family gives you money, you get some inheritance, you get the lottery, you're not going to all of a sudden know how to plan it, because if you were poor before, you are going to be poor afterwards. If you didn't know how to handle money or to be wise with it. You know, a fool and his money is soon parted. And for very many years, I was that fool. I spent being naive. I was going through the debt cycle, credit card debt. I mean, you name it. So when me and my wife hit rock bottom and you're eating humble pie, I said, I'm either going to get free of this or we're going to die trying. And we grabbed every book we possibly could on financial literacy just to try and learn to speak the language. Because, and I don't fault anybody who struggles with understanding finances. Finances is math. And if you don't understand the language of finance, it's kind of like in your home, if your parents don't speak Mandarin Chinese, you're never going to learn Mandarin Chinese at home. So if your parents don't teach you financial literacy, the odds of you learning it are slim to none. So that's the hard part, is too many of us in society are not taught, and then we become victims of that repetitive cycle. So you have to learn it, and you have to retrain your brain. So, you know, we were reading books like Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover, the Richest Man in Babylon, and that's one of my favorite reads. Have you had the opportunity to read that one?
I have. Yep.
That's a classic. That's a fun little read. It's probably like, what, 100 pages, and super cheap. You can get it on Amazon. And if any of your listeners have a desire to start a financial journey of their own, that is such a great book to light that fire in a fun way. So go get yourself a copy of The Richest Man in Babylon. And if you don't absolutely love it, you can email me and I'll refund your money, because I'll buy the book from you and I'll give it to somebody who will appreciate it.
So what other books did you find useful?
You know, The Millionaire Next Door. I mean, God, like,
I've
realistically,
read that one too.
You just, yeah. And it just, you know, it makes you think, like, getting successful is not about status symbols. Getting successful is about, you know, proudly eating that bit of ramen at home, or, you know, cooking your breakfast and not eating out, and avoiding the car payment. And me and my wife, when I was contracting, I had a big, beautiful lifted Ford F-350 diesel, and we had to eat some humble pie, and I sold it. And I fortunately had some positive equity in it, like $1,500. And I found an old engineering company that had an old rusty GMC pickup, but it had a rebuilt engine in it. And I paid $1,500 for this old rust bucket. And I drove that son of a gun for 5 years.
Wow.
And the door, you'd open the door and it would drop 2 inches. The cushion, the padding on the seat was gone. So you'd sit right on the springs. And my family made fun of me. They're like, and finally, when we started getting out of debt, my family said, Span, like, you, I know you got a little bit of money put away. Why don't you guys go get a new vehicle? And I'm like, well, it's still running, so who cares? I don't care what anyone thinks, because I remember what it felt like. I paid the bank's payment for a vehicle that I didn't own for years and years and years. And I finally had a truck that I owned. And it was a piece of crap, but I was proud of my piece of crap. You know what I mean? Nobody had claim to my time, and yet I still had transportation, you know?
Yeah, it was doing the job that needed to be done.
Right.
And you can be grateful for that.
Yeah, yeah. And I had coworkers that would tease me about, you know, my kind of modest transportation. And finally, I had to tease one of the guys back. And I won't say the gentleman's name. And I said, hey, so-and-so. You know, he's making fun of me. You know, nice beater truck. And I said, hey, so-and-so. I said, you know, what's really funny is you're going to the bank and you're going to go deposit it your check into the bank's account. I said, I'm going to the bank and I'm going to deposit my check into my account. So who's the idiot there?
Ouch.
Yeah,
but no, your point is well taken, though. It's sad when you realize how much of ourselves sometimes gets wrapped up in what I drive, what I wear, you know, what my neighborhood is, and it's I guess it's status. You know, there's nothing more simple. It's just status. And it turns out we can all live with a slightly diminished status and still be grateful for, you know, what we have.
Yeah. And me and my wife, it went from feeling like a sacrifice to actually feeling like an opportunity, like a privilege and fun. And for us, as soon as a bill got paid off, you felt a little less weight on your shoulder and you felt a little less weight on your shoulder. And eventually it got to a beautiful moment where there was the last bill was gone and we didn't have any more accounts that we had to deposit the money to. You know, is this going to a credit card, or is this going to a car payment, or is this going to this? And finally there was no other accounts to pay off.
Wow.
But our own. So it started going. So once you get that moment of freedom where you're like, wow, this actually goes into my account. Nobody has a claim on my time. I'm free. And it's so invigorating to put your first like $500 away. And and everyone should have an emergency fund. So I use that as kind of a, your first keeping amount outside of your emergency fund. But instead of putting $500 on a credit card, it's like, well, I have nobody else that I owe this to. So I could put this in my account. And then the next month there's a little more and there's a little more. And you kind of realize, you're like, wow, I have 6 months worth of money in my bank account. And that's just the start. That's a humble beginning. But you're like, you think, I could quit my job for 6 months. So if a coworker yells at you or you have a boss that's a total jerk and you realize that you have, you know, a couple of months worth of bills. And so you don't have to work because you have to. You're working every day now because you want to, because you have a little bit of freedom. If you were in a completely toxic work situation, you could leave and go find a job and you have 6 months worth of bills put away. So you realize that every time an aggressive coworker or maybe a nasty customer or something, you're there because you want to, not because you have to. So you're tolerating that because you have the freedom to do so. And it feels so much more freeing to do so. And as me and my wife went through that liberating philosophy and we had money, we didn't want to spend it because then you realize you were trading that freedom and opportunity for a little bit of consumption. You're like, I don't really need the steak dinner tonight. We're just going to go get something a little more modest. And
Spencer,
we had really... Sorry, go ahead.
We're unfortunately coming up on the end of the segment here. I want to have you back on the show again because I think this is going to be kind of a topic that deserves to be revisited. One of the things I remember most is you told me how you and your wife would actually make a game out of how can we have the cheapest date possible? And rather than
that was
being
a lot of fun.
Yeah, instead of being drudgery, it boosted your imagination. And you guys, I don't know, it sounded like a pretty cool idea. Nevertheless, yeah. Spencer Worthington, thank you. Thank you for being on my show. Thanks for being my sponsor, too. I truly
Always
appreciate
a privilege.
It, friend. All right.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
All right, welcome back to the show. Our program is brought to you in part by Dixie Chiropractic. You can visit them at dixiechiro.com. This is fantastic news for my listeners in Southern Utah, especially if you're dealing with pain, like from a car accident injury or from bulging herniated discs or neuropathy. Just go to dixiechiro.com. I actually include a link in my show notes under sponsors. You can click on that link and learn about the $99 intro special for bulging herniated discs. Check this out. $99 gets you two treatments plus a massage. That's a deal. If you're dealing with neuropathy, here's the $99 Calmer treatment plus massage. Get all the details at dixiechiro.com. Again, that's Dr. Ward Wagner, Dixie Chiropractic. Their website is dixiechiro.com. I guess you've probably noticed that the folks who are so desperate to save us from misinformation just happen to be the same ones who are weaponizing the current thing in order to silence dissent. I've got a great article here from Jordan Schachtel on his dossier Substack. Weaponizing the current thing, Biden's Ministry of Truth and its origins. And he says, this is not about tackling foreign disinformation. This is not about protecting you from the Russians interfering, you know, by feeding bad information to us. This is about the Department of Homeland Security targeting domestic dissent. And that's why you and I cannot just shrug it off as, well, you know, politicians are going to do what they're going to do. This is pretty serious stuff. In fact, I don't know if you have seen any of the video of what's happening right now. Now, granted, there's a state of war taking place in Ukraine, but one of the most chilling videos that I've seen in a long time was, we're talking fully armored up soldiers coming into people's homes at gunpoint, taking people away because they had posted something that was unflattering on social media. They had posted something that was supportive of, you know, Russia, or they had posted something that they felt was disrespectful. The thing that got me was the guy's like, you're not being very respectful of the flag, because someone had posted something of the Ukraine flag and said, you know, this is a flag that stands for murder and for deception or something. Anyway, so this is a blood-soaked rag. You may disagree strongly, right? I mean, maybe you think Russia is totally in the wrong, and that could very well be the case. But the idea that Ukraine just passed laws saying, you know, you can't dissent, you cannot in any way show that you aren't fully behind us and that you may have doubts, you know, you can't show that you have any questions of those in power. Now, that's an extreme situation, but that's logically where we are headed on the current track that we're facing. And it's not going to take a matter of, you know, Russia attacking us and war and, you know, bombs flying and whatnot to make that happen. You can see the American political class is gearing up for a preemptive shutdown of dissent, a clampdown. I'm sure they would love to do it before the midterm elections because I think they're very fearful of what's about to happen. Here's how Jordan Schachtel puts it. He says, what has the Department of Homeland Security's Disinformation Governance Board, or rather the Biden administration's Ministry of Truth, been up to since its founding? Nobody really knows, but the timeline of its creation coincides with increasingly disturbing activities launched within Homeland Security to target not Russians, but American citizens. He says, far from targeting foreign disinformation or anything of the sort, the activities of the Department of Homeland Security have increasingly focused on targeting and surveilling domestic dissent. We only know about the Truth Ministry's origin timeline because its appointed leader, progressive activist Nina Jankowicz, revealed as much on Twitter. Her exact words were, cat's out of the bag, here's what I've been up to the past 2 months and why I've been a bit quiet on here. Honored to be serving in the Biden administration at DHS.gov or DHS.gov and helping them shape our counter-disinformation efforts. So prior to the announcement from the Department of Homeland Security last week, there was no sign of such a disinformation governance board outfit operating within the federal bureaucracy. But there are clues and a track record of similar outfits that may have served as predecessors to the current namesake. So if you're looking for answers from the government, well, you're not going to get any. Jordan Schachtel says the people in charge of the Truth Ministry, unsurprisingly, have no intention of being honest about its founding function and leadership. In an interview over the weekend, DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, Jankowicz's boss, claimed she was eminently qualified, a renowned expert, and politically neutral. Now, that neutral claim is laughably absurd, as Jankowicz has openly campaigned for Democratic politicians, and most notably, the notorious disinformation launderer that is Hillary Clinton. Jankowicz appears to have personal and professional ties to the Clinton cartel through her work as a Fulbright Clinton Fellow, a job that included her serving as an advisor to the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry. By the way, he backs all this up with links to establish this is not just something he's pulling out of thin air. Jordan Schachtel says, now that any sane person can clearly establish that Jankowicz is a political activist who has no interest in separating truth from disinformation, let's get back to the Department of Homeland Security component. DHS claims the Disinformation Governance Board, led by Russia specialist Jankowicz, has a primary mission that will focus on tackling misinformation that leads to migrant surges at the U.S. border in addition to combating supposed disinformation coming from Russia. Now, he says it's unclear why Jankowicz would lead an organization that ostensibly targets non-English-speaking Latin American residents, given that she has the fact that she has no established familiarity with the languages spoken by the vast majority of migrants. He says, additionally, it's the State Department that has traditionally held the role of managing propaganda and counter-propaganda operations, especially when it comes to Eastern Europe and Russia, which is the niche focus of Jankowicz's career thus far. Schachtel says perhaps the real target of the Ministry of Truth is the American people, specifically Americans who don't conform with the current thing. Now, the campaigns took a rapidly aggressive posture against peaceful American political opposition in late 2021 when the Department of Homeland Security issued a series of memos classifying opponents of COVID lockdowns as potential domestic violent extremists. Right? You remember that? Well, DHS also warned about these so-called extremists discussing conspiracy theories concerning the origins of COVID-19 and effectiveness of vaccines. Despite the vaccines not actually working and the origins of COVID-19 being repeatedly covered up by the federal bureaucracy. At around the same time of the Truth Ministry's apparent founding, DHS was continuing to issue increasingly noxious bulletins targeting not foreigners, but American citizens, classing them as disinformation agents and potential violent extremists. I mean, here's a direct quote from one of their missives. Meanwhile, COVID-19 mitigation measures, particularly COVID-19 vaccine and mask mandates, have been used by domestic violent extremists to justify violence since 2020 and could continue to inspire these extremists to target government, healthcare, and academic institutions that they associate with those measures. Now, Jordan Schachtel says a possible predecessor to the Disinformation Governance Board is an outfit that sprung up in February called the Mis, Dis, and Malinformation Team, or MDM, which was tasked with building national resilience to MDM and foreign influence activities. Now, this MDM team was established at DHS through the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, which is most notably in charge of overseeing election integrity issues. He says in February, at the same time, around the same time, rather, as the apparent founding of the Disinformation Governance Board, DHS likened opposition to lockdowns as a sign of likely terrorist behavior. In fact, the most notable aspect of a domestic terrorist is a person who will sow discord and undermine public trust in government institutions, DHS said. Whoops. Sorry. I just felt a little chill go up my spine there. Jordan Schachtel says COVID-19 mitigation measures, particularly COVID-19 vaccine and mask mandates, have been used by domestic violent extremists to justify violence since 2020 and could continue to inspire these extremists to target those government, healthcare, and academic institutions they associate with those measures. I mean, this is directly from the government, the horse's mouth, you know, so to speak. So it continues, claiming that those who disseminate what's called false or misleading narratives regarding unsubstantiated widespread election fraud and COVID-19 are signs of a likely terrorist. There's no public track record for the Disinformation Governance Board, but he says many hints are pointing to the reality of an organization established to continue surveilling and harassing the Biden administration's domestic political opposition under the guise of fighting disinformation. So Jordan Schachtel says, whether it's a war in Ukraine or your next mRNA COVID shot, you'd better be on the right side of their current thing, or you might just be labeled a potential violent extremist terrorist. And he says the Ministry of Truth will serve as a complementary instrument for that system. I know. Maybe the sky isn't falling. Maybe this is just Henny Penny running around, you know, or Chicken Little, sorry, running around saying that, oh no, this is a big deal. I think it is a big deal, though. And the timing, more than anything, is what makes me wonder if the noose isn't being tightened, again, in preparation for those upcoming midterm elections. Politicians are scared. Maybe they have good reason to be.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.